Donald Trump became America's most prominent felon on Thursday when a New York jury convicted him on 34 bogus counts of falsifying business records. That verdict has proven predictably controversial. New York's case against Trump has attracted bipartisan criticism ever since Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg indicted the former president last year. Of all the cases brought against Trump, New York's charges have always looked both the least solid and the least serious. Nevertheless, convict him they did. Joining us now to bring us an analysis of the verdict is constitutional law expert Paul Kaminar. He is lead counsel for the National Legal and Policy Center based in Washington, D.C. Mr. Kaminar is a public policy and appellate attorney who counsels clients in legal, regulatory, and public policy matters. As an appellate attorney, I can't wait to talk appeals process with him. Paul, thank you for joining us tonight. It's nice to have you on the show, my friend.
Yeah, thank you for having me, John. My pleasure.
So, Paul, was this a criminal trial or a political persecution? Because it sure seemed to me like it was the latter.
Yeah, it certainly was, in my opinion. I mean, this case was a farce from the very beginning. Keep in mind that the prosecutor here, local DA Alvin Bragg, ran for office vowing to get Donald Trump. So it started out with that kind of a political motive to bringing the case. And then he didn't do anything as prior predecessor didn't do anything about the case. It was only until Donald Trump decided to run for office that they decided to go after him. So we have it starting with a political vendetta, so to speak, and it was motivated that way, and it came through during the whole trial. You had the judge, Juan Merchan, who has donated money to the Biden campaign and a committee whose mission is to stop Republicans. That right there should have caused him to recuse himself from the case. I've never heard of a judge giving political contributions, let alone to the opponent of the guy who's he has before him in a criminal trial.
Right.
So that was amazing. And he said, no, I'm not getting off the case. Then the trial itself was replete with all kinds of errors in terms of the judge not sustaining objections by the defense on testimony by the prosecution witnesses like Stormy Daniels, who let her go on and on about the salacious details of her encounter or rendezvous with Trump that was totally prejudicial to Trump and had nothing to do with false business entries. And then the biggest error that I see was the jury instructions. I mean, it wasn't until the end of the case that the prosecutor finally revealed to the jury, oh, by the way, in order to find Donald Trump guilty, you have to find that these falsified business records was done to cover up one of three different other crimes that are felonies.
Right.
And take your pick.
Yeah.
As if this is a cafeteria menu.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Paul. How? Explain to me how that works, because, you know, those of us who spend a night at a Holiday Inn Express and think we're lawyers or watch an episode of Law and Order all know that concept of unanimous, jury must be unanimous. And yet here we have this case where the jury can disagree, and yet the judge considers it unanimous. Will we ever know how the jury voted? Will we ever know how this played out? How did they get to this? How is that even legal?
Right. Yeah, no, good question. Yeah, the only way we would know what happened in the jury room is if the media or reporter gets to a couple of jurors and asks them to explain how they got to their conviction.
Isn't there a jury sheet? I kept talking, you know, some of the commentators were talking. Will they release that, or is that
jury sheet? Yeah, jury sheet was a very simplistic thing where they had listed the 34 counts that were all the same counts, you know. Did he falsify records? And in the right column, it has you check the box either guilty or not guilty. So once you found him guilty of one, it's just a matter of repeating it 33 other times.
Okay.
So it was a no-brainer. But there wasn't any sub-boxes to check. Which of the three felonies are you basing this on? And we would never have known, but in any event, if they split different ways, the judge would still say it doesn't matter. He's still guilty. So
but how is that legal if they disagree?
Well, we don't think it is, and we will certainly find out in the Court of Appeals, if not there, the Supreme Court. Now, the government says, well, this has been a law on the books here in New York. It's never been really challenged in the federal court or Supreme Court. They're claiming that, well, you know, you don't have to find that whatever the ultimate cover-up crime was, as long as you think he had falsified records for this crime. So it's kind of a stretch, to be sure. I mean, they said, well, it's like when you charge someone for breaking into a house with the intent to commit another crime. So they're saying breaking into the house is a crime, but it's an aggravated crime and a felony if you intend to commit another crime, such as robbing the house.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, whatever. And they said we don't have to say what that other crime was. But here it's not the same level of that kind of a crime, because the judge specified there are three different crimes that he could have committed. And what the prosecutor is saying and what the media is saying is that, oh, his ultimate crime was to violate the Federal Election Campaign Act by influencing the election. Well, first of all, that was only one of the three choices. So we don't know whether they picked that one or whether they picked the one that said the business records were falsified for evading New York or federal tax laws. So they could very well have said that, but the way it's being spun by the prosecutor and the media is that this was done to violate federal election laws. All right, so let's assume it was. That was the reason why they chose that. Why is that doesn't hold up? Doesn't hold up principally because under our election laws, a candidate can spend as much money as he wants of his own money on his own campaign.
Right, exactly.
Whether it's to hire staff, whether it's to buy computers, or whether to buy new suits so it makes him look good on the campaign trail, or whether it's to pay for a non-disclosure agreement so that the information doesn't come out that makes him look bad.
Right. If it's his own money, he can do anything he wants with it.
That's right. There's no limit. And if you look at the jury instructions, which I have, under the paragraph about federal election law, it says it is a violation of the federal election law for someone to give more than $2,700 to a candidate. Well, that's true for the average Joe. So the jury might say, well, let's see, $130,000 for the non-disclosure agreement. Yeah, that's more than $2,700. So, yeah, that's what he was trying to violate. But wait a minute. He's not subject to the $2,700 limit
right.
as a candidate. So the whole thing is a mess.
Yeah, I know. I ran for the House, the limits for Kansas House reps is $500, and I donated $2,500 to my first campaign. So technically, there you go. If I were in New York, I'd be guilty because we're talking with Paul Kaminar. He's lead counsel for the National Legal and Policy Center. Paul, let's talk sentencing. Sentencing is scheduled for July 11th, and looking at how this judge handled the trial, is there any doubt in your mind that Trump won't get jail time here?
Yeah, I think he probably will get some time because he already was found in violation of the judge's gag order, and the judge finally said, look, you do this again, I'm going to throw you in jail. So he's already shown that he's willing to do that. But even if Bragg asks for jail time, and even if Bershon decides to impose it, I have really no doubt that that will judgment be stayed pending appeals. So what
and the appellate
do
court
is,
does that, right?
Well, Bershon can, but the way you do it procedurally, you first ask the judge, okay, Your Honor, you impose a sentence. Can you put a timeout on this from having it go into effect while we go on appeal? He can either say yay or nay. If he says nope, I want him to report to prison next month after, and it may be something else, maybe home detention, maybe probation, whatever.
Right.
Then you go to the Court of Appeals of New York and say, hey, look, could you put a timeout on this while we appeal the underlying conviction and sentence? And if they say, no, we're going along with Bershon, then you go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, look, you guys need to issue a timeout for both these lower courts because we have some serious legal arguments, and it doesn't make sense for our client to be carrying out a sentence if his conviction is ultimately going to be reversed. So he may do that. He may also do something like saying, I hereby, he can impose, by the way, under the law for this particular crime up to 4 years. So he may say, I hereby sent you to 1 year in prison, but I will stay that sentence and put you on probation for 2 years, meaning that if you violate any terms of your probation, then I'm going to come back before me and then I'll carry out the imprisonment sentence. So there's various ways that this can go down. But in any event, I don't see, even if he imposes jail time with Trump's thing a day, behind bars or in home detention and keeping him off the campaign trail, whatever, until the appeal runs out.
And how long can that take? I know we're coming up on a break here, but how long? This whole thing, we're well past the election. We're talking probably end of the year, next year.
Well, yeah, the appeal will go well into next year in terms of briefing and having the oral argument and then filing a decision. So this will go well into next year.
Shame any Christmas. Yeah, well, folks, buckle up. It's going to be a while. Paul, thank you again for joining us this evening. If folks want to, sure. You've got a lot of articles that you've written on this and other topics. If folks want to check those out, they can find it at nlpc.org, correct?
That's correct. That's our website. I appreciate any support we can get. We're a small organization, but we go after the bad guys and hope we can keep our work going on.
Appreciate you. Thank you again for joining us, my friend. Nice to have you on the show again.
Thank you. Anytime, John.
Thank you, Paul. Jeff, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for sticking around.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine, thank you.
I just really wanted to call without the utmost sincerity to just call and wish you guys a happy Gay Pride Month. I know that this is Steve and Ted's favorite month of the whole year. I know those guys have been together a long time.
They have been together a long time, although I have to be honest with you, my pride flag is red, white, and blue. So, but yes, if you're into gay pride, I commend you, and that's, it's a free country, so, I'm happy for you. It's your choice, and I'm happy for you.
I also heard that it's one of, Jed Chambers' favorite months of the whole year. Going to be coloring his hair. I hear that in the morning.
You should call the morning show if you want to talk to those guys. Call them. I'm sure they'd love to hear from you.
I want to get everybody excited. I hear they're going to have a couple of drag queens and doing story hour in the morning. It's going to be really off the hook over there at Steve and Ted, I hear.
I will let them know that you called and hope that they have a drag queen story hour on Steve and Ted. I think that would be hilarious. I doubt they'll do it, but hey, you know what? If they want to do that for their audience, hey, good for them. I won't do that for my audience, but hey, it's a free country. So, Jeff, but no, seriously, if you're celebrating Pride Month, again, that's good for you. My Pride Month, is red, white, and blue. So that's, hey, one in every crowd. Pat, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for calling.
country. And real good guest tonight.
Thank you.
Statue of Limitation should have been mentioned on here.
Yes, you know, you're right, because that Statue of Limitations is long expired, even if he was guilty. And even if which the whole thing's trumped up anyway. You see what I did there? But the whole thing is bogus anyway. But you're right, the Statue of Limitations is long expired.
And the misdemeanor is what it should have been at the most.
At the most.
And don't forget where this all started. Cohen was his personal attorney, Trump's personal private attorney. His office was raided, and he was held in a cell for 3-4 months, and having his office raided, and his life looked over very carefully, and in essence, he was shown tax returns, and it said that you will never see your children again if you're not going to cooperate with us. And they turned him. The next day, he was on the daytime shows, how bad Trump is. They turned him like a North Korean prisoner of war.
Yeah.
And it was real dirty play.
If you know, by the way, thank you, Pat. Thanks for calling. And it's nice to have Pat back calling again. I missed you while we were on. I was taking guest hosts, by the way, Pat. But, you know, we didn't get to watch the trial. I wish that would have been incredible television. But if you watch during the day and the news, you know, mainstream news was covering it, if you're able to read the transcripts during the trial, if you watched any of Cohen's testimony, you could read and you could tell the lies. And it was so obvious when the defense got to cross-examine him how much he was lying. So, I don't know how a jury could find him credible until the judge gives the instructions. And then the judge basically gave them an out that said, well, it doesn't matter that he lied. It doesn't matter that he lied to you. The judge, in his instructions, basically threw this trial. The judge is the one who's to blame here. I don't blame the jury. The jury could not convict him. Based on the instructions given to the jury, what option did they have? That judge had it in for Donald Trump from the very beginning. I mean, just look at the gag order. There's just so many opportunities for an appeal here. They've got a dozen or more reasons, grounds for appeal. And the whole thing is a sham. It's a joke. It's just unfortunate that we're having to go through this. But it is what it is. And hopefully when we come out of it, our republic is better for it. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, author Daniel Greenfield will explain why the DNC has switched to a virtual convention in order to protect Joe Biden. They're afraid for Joe. They got to protect him. It's the reason why he doesn't do press conferences. There's a reason why he can't answer a question. Now they're afraid of even a challenge at their own convention. Biden easily racked up the delegates needed to become the party's standard bearer. That's what happens when you rig elections. That was done by March, but the continued protest votes against him in Democratic primaries and his perceived weakness as a general election candidate has left open the door to the remote possibility of a surprise challenge and even a brokered convention when the party meets in Chicago in August. So Democrats, therefore, announced this week that President Joe Biden will be named their nominee for president virtually, which has basically deflated what little drama could have been expected at the Democratic National Convention. So why is the DNC so afraid of an open floor debate in Chicago? With us now to answer that question is Daniel Greenfield, author of Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. Daniel, thank you for joining us this evening. It's nice to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Daniel, isn't this really about locking in the nomination for Biden and avoiding any kind of floor fight? Because, you know, there's a fair amount of loonies on the left, the pro-Palestinian, you know, Hamas folks, we didn't get our student loan bailout money. There's a chunk of them that, and maybe there's some that just don't think he can win, that would like somebody else.
I mean, there's absolutely going to be the leftist protests, riots, fork disruption, but I think that's not the real concern here. There's never been a candidate that's been this unpopular within his own party. You look at the polls in the past, you know, they're all going to vote for him. They all voted for him during the primaries. Not that there was that much of a choice. They made sure there wouldn't be much of a choice. but he is still really spectacularly unpopular among Democrats. And so many people, even in the professional Democrat class, the people I talk to, are absolutely nervous. They are worried. They don't think he can win. I mean, even David Axelrod, who was Obama's guy, yep. came out and at one point suggested, yeah, maybe this would be a good time for him to reconsider. So they're absolutely worried about their own people turning on him. They're worried if there's going to be any kind of option, if there's going to be any kind of opening for a floor fight, Biden could absolutely be demolished. So they're making sure they're doing this virtual roll call. They're using Ohio as an excuse. But they've done this all throughout. They've rigged the process because they know how unpopular Biden is, not with ordinary Americans, not with independents, but just within Democrats. Every time I talk to a Democrat, they absolutely do not understand why he's even the candidate.
Yeah, well, and clearly that's why Robert Kennedy Jr. is running as an independent, is because the Democrat Party basically threw him out because they considered him a threat. And it's why they're now attacking him incessantly, won't let him in the debates, things like that, which, by the way, I'm surprised they're even letting Joe Biden do a debate. I don't think he'll fare well unless they jack him up on cocaine or something. But what are the chances of Newsom, or even more implausibly, Michelle Obama or somebody swooping in at the convention? Is that, I mean, I think back in the day people were afraid of that. Is that even possible now? Or with this, is that now going to be not an option?
It would take a whole lot. You know, if those people wanted to come in, the big guns, they would have come in a whole lot earlier in the process. They chose to sit this one out. They decided that Biden's people had the party locked down. It was his turn. They're going to let him do that. You know, next time around, they're absolutely, you know, certainly Newsom is going to show up. He's got the money. He's got the inside track. But I don't think it's going to happen at this convention. You know, if they actually decide to remove him, it's not going to be a convention floor fight. It's going to be a private session where everybody important in the party is going to step forward and tell him, you have to step down now. This is your legacy. And by the way, you know, your son has got multiple trials and we can do something about that. So, and then that he's going to announce that he's very sick at this point. He's not, his health does not let him continue. And this is who his replacement is. But I would predict this is not going to happen.
We're talking with Daniel Greenfield, author of Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. This isn't the only issue the DNC is worried about at the convention, though, Daniel. I mean, they're very concerned, I know, about this being another 1968 Chicago convention. That one, I, for the record, I wasn't even alive, but that one was mired in violent protests. They are really concerned about the optics of that happening again, though, as well, aren't they?
They absolutely are, especially considering Mayor Brandon Johnson, the radical leftist elected in Chicago, has made it pretty clear that he supports the protesters, which, of course, has put even more pressure on Biden to quickly bail out Hamas to avoid having the negative stuff happening at his convention. He's tried to give them everything he's wanted. They've wanted. He's tried to give the left everything they wanted since day one. He's turned his administration over to them, but it's just never going to be enough. And that's the tragedy he finds himself facing. He sold out whatever beliefs he had. You go back to the 1980s, 1990s, whatever he stood for, he's dumped all of those things. He was originally running as a moderate Democrat, then as a liberal Democrat. Now he's just a plain socialist, and still the left is not going to have him, let him have his moment in the sun.
Daniel, let me ask you this. Do you think Biden has, you say, you know, Biden has sold out, Biden has done this, do you think Biden has done these things, or do you think Biden is just doing what he's told? I don't know if he's cognitively aware of stuff, or if it's the people, Ron Plain, Valerie Jarrett, the people behind him who are really running things. I don't know if Joe Biden is actively making these decisions, or if they're just saying, okay, Joey, go in here, read the notes, then we'll get you an ice cream. I mean, I don't believe that he's actively making these decisions.
Honestly, we have so many of these 80-year-olds in the Senate in general, and those people just rely on their aides. And even the people who are in their 60s or their 40s, in many cases, they're relying on their aides. Their aides know what's going on. Their aides know what they're voting for. Their aides know what their floor schedule is. Some of these people really have no idea. And Biden has been that way for decades, even before whatever problems he had kicked in. So he knows what it takes to stay in power, which is to cut deals with everybody. And, you know, he relies on these leftists that he brought in, the Warren people, the Sanders people, the Obama people, to tell him what deals he needs to cut and what he needs to give the left.
So that, I think you're right. And I think when you look at, like, these campus protests over the war in Gaza, Biden's, you know, he gets disrupted nearly everywhere he goes. And I think the organizers of the Chicago convention are plotting on how to prevent and preempt these opportunities for heckling. I'm really curious, do you think we're going to see a normal convention, or are they really going to do their best to put on a show, but it won't look like what we've seen in the past?
There are going to be disruptions. If the disruptions get bad, I suspect we're going to see a semi-virtual convention. During COVID, we already got a virtual Democratic convention. We know what it looks like. We know they can put one on. I'm sure they're going to have celebrities waiting in the wings in some pre-taped segments with Biden and top Democrats. And if things get messy, the networks are going to very compliantly cut to the virtual materials. They would never do that, of course, with Republicans.
No.
When there are disruptions that are going to happen with the RNC, they're absolutely not doing that. But with the Democrats, they're going to go along and they'll air the pre-taped stuff if they need to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If this was a Republican, because I've been to two Republican national conventions, and I'm sure you're absolutely right. If this was the RNC, they'd have all the cameras trained on the protesters. And I think you're right. At the DNC, they'll play the canned foot. Fox won't, but the others will. Let me ask you, and I know this is kind of off topic, but since we're talking about, how do you think Biden's going to fare in these debates? Do you think he's capable of handling a debate?
Well, remember, unfortunately, Republicans once again fell into the usual habit of letting the left moderate their debates.
Yeah,
it's going to be CNN people.
I'm very disappointed.
Which means they're going to have the questions ahead of time. All they have to do is get Biden to memorize some of the same talking points he's been dispensing over and over again. They're going to ask him, do you feel Trump represents a threat to democracy? And he's going to go into his, and he's going to ask him, what are you going to do about the environment and, you know, and student loans? It's going to be tilted to the left. And it's also going to be the same talking points he's been doing over and over again. And they're going to give them the questions they gave him to Hillary ahead of time. So as long as he can stay awake and at least marginally focused, it's not going to be a complete disaster, much as we saw in 2020. That's how they do it.
You've got the book out. It's called Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. It's available on Amazon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, you know, it was written in 2020. I was seeing all the insanity around, and so many people were in a state of despair. And the important message was that we've been dealing with this with the left for over 200 years. There was a left that was fighting the Constitution, fighting against George Washington, and they did it. They survived. America survived 200 years. We can survive Joe Biden, too.
You know, my wife and I actually were talking about this the other night, and you know, she was worried, and I think a lot of us are worried about what we're seeing today, what's going on in the country today, and I'm glad to hear that even so far back as our founding fathers, they too had to fight against the left. I think some of these battles that we're seeing now are a little more pronounced. I think it's a little more dramatic. I certainly think the culture war is worse now than it's ever been. But it's nice to know that some of these same fights were still being fought back in the 1700s. So, Daniel, thank you again for joining us this evening. Again, the book is Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. Thank you again for joining us, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ron, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for sticking around. Appreciate you joining us this evening.
Yeah, John. One thing I wanted to talk to you about is I think the people in the country, the politicians, are missing out, especially the right, on what's happening. The inflation is not the problem. Border is not the problem. There's many more problems out there, but the big problem is this Marxist bit that's in our colleges, in our schools. They dumb down our kids. And if you go into Google and Google Karl Marx manifesto, how many died on account of Karl Marx, it states millions and possibly billions. The Marxists, when they take over, they don't want your land. I mean, they don't want your people. They want your land, and they don't want the people. The people are the least thing that they want. If, for instance, when they went into Russia, they planted wheat 6 inches deep so it wouldn't sprout to kill and starve to death millions. And I don't know why the politicians don't get on this, especially the right, and tell them what's coming. You know, inflation might hurt you, but a gas chamber will hurt you a lot more. And that's where we're headed. Guaranteed, 100%.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is Marxists, it's so funny because if you look at what Karl Marx taught about education, he always said that education was a tool of the bourgeoisie, a tool of the capitalist ruling class. And Marxists right. have always argued that education was really just designed to reproduce class inequalities and to subvert essentially the workforce. And he always felt like education was a tool of the ruling class. And so I think it's so funny that now that's where they're teaching it is in the higher education. And unfortunately, it's creeping down into secondary education. So I just think it's ironic that Marx, who taught as one of his core fundamentals was that the education system in and of itself was a tour of the rich and the bourgeoisie, is now they're literally teaching it in the very system that he was so opposed to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they've done down the young generation where, well, then you're worried about baseball and softball and track. They could care less about what's going on in Washington, D.C. and the basic rulers of this country, as you might call them today.
Well, and his whole concept was that you had to persuade the working class, the proletariat, to accept their subjugation as normal, and that was natural, and that they, you know, therefore it was easier to basically to control them. And Ron, I appreciate the call, but it was so much easier therefore to control the working class if they essentially sat in their place. And so it's easier to control them if they're uneducated. And even though education fosters equal opportunity, that's not what they want. And that capitalism is a myth, which is one of the reasons why Marxists hate the concept of capitalism, because capitalism builds everyone up and it equal opportunity to let everyone rise above their station. But of course, that's not what Marxists want. They want this false equality that we're all equal. The problem is they want everybody poor and dependent on the government. And this false equivalency that says, well, we're all going to be equal. No, because there's still class systems within the Marxist system. It's just all poor with few rich people at the top. And that's what they don't want. But the sad part is they're out of touch. And that's what we're seeing time and time again. I mean, Bernie Sanders is a perfect example of a socialist who's a millionaire, who loves to rail against the millionaires and billionaires while he is a millionaire. But that's the hypocrisy of the left, and it's what we're having to find every day and deal with on a daily basis. Thank you for joining us tonight. We got a great show planned next week. Anthony Scaramucci, you're going to know that name. I'm sure you've heard it before. He will be one of our guests next Sunday. In the meantime, carry on, fellow deplorables.